A person of interest today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Vladimir Putin said Russian investigators have some questions for the former U.S. ambassador in Moscow. Michael McFaul says President Trump's responses have been less than reassuring.
When he said yesterday, America's no longer under attack, well, guess what? I'm an American, and I feel like I'm under attack right now.
Who are the suspects in this story? The GRU. That's the Russian Military Intelligence Service.
Really, from its earliest beginnings, these have been the guys who, as well as doing conventional espionage, are absolutely willing to get their hands dirty and absolutely willing to go into dangerous and uncontrolled spaces.
And some disturbing allegations in Yemen with implications for the U.S. Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It has been a wild week of news, still dominated by that 45-minute press conference on Monday in Helsinki. Remember this moment?
I think that's an incredible offer.
That incredible offer from President Vladimir Putin includes handing over 11 Americans, including a former ambassador, to Russia for questioning. As part of the deal, the Kremlin would allow the U.S. to interview the 12 Russian officials indicted last week in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe. On Monday in Helsinki, President Trump seemed to be jumping at the offer. On Wednesday, the White House said it wasn't ruling it out. This afternoon, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said President Trump now disagrees with the offer. The willingness, though, to even contemplate handing over a former ambassador had drawn anger and astonishment from current and former U.S. officials. A State Department spokesperson called the idea absolutely absurd. Near the top of the list of Americans Russia wants to question, former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul. He joined us from Stanford University just prior to the White House changing its position again, and I asked him why he thought Russian officials wanted to interview him.
Vladimir Putin considers me to be a big critic of his and causing trouble, so this is a way to intimidate me. It's a way to go after me one more time.
Putin's got lots of critics. Why do you think you're at the top of the list?
Oh, because I'm talking to you, Marco. I mean, I'm a pretty loud critic with a pretty big platform. And, you know, unlike some other people, I know that system well. I've, you know, not only was I the U.S. ambassador, but I've lived in that country for many years. I know how it works. And this is classic Putin, just to be clear. What he did, it's called whataboutism. That's a very classic mechanism that they use. So there's an indictment that comes out on Friday. And by the time he gets to Helsinki, he said, okay, you want to arrest several of our government officials? Well, we want to do the same with several of yours. You make mistakes, we make mistakes, you know, it's all kind of the same thing. And tragically, our president basically underscored that whataboutism. He said that we're all at fault. America's done a lot of stupid things. Russia's done some bad things, we've done some bad things, but then took it one step further and said to the world at that press conference he thought this was a good idea to have people like me be interrogated.
And do you think the Russians might have something, some kind of criminal charge on you, or they would want to speak with you because they think you know stuff?
Well, the authorities have made it very clear that they think me and the other Americans were somehow involved in the money laundering scheme that allegedly Bill Bretter did. So these are allegations of criminal charges. I want to be clear about that. It's not just let's get some information from the former ambassador. It
right.
is crystal clear. Putin himself was clear about it in the Helsinki press conference. He just didn't mention our names. And just, I mean, I think it should be obvious, but this is completely absurd, crazy, cockamamie story, completely fabricated, nothing to do with Bill Browder. You know, I worked as a White House official and the U.S. ambassador.
And just a reminder, Bill Browder is the investment fund manager and Putin critic. So could this happen, or is it all just bravado? I mean, could you be sent to Russia, and are you taking any precautions?
I think that's highly unlikely. Of course, I'm taking precautions and, you know, with legal counsel and reaching out to Trump administration officials. But I think that's highly unlikely. But is it likely that I might show up in some third country and have a notice there for my arrest from the Russians? Tragically, I fear that that could happen. I mean, let's be clear. There's no rule of law in Russia. There's no process. There's no legality. There's no facts. This is the way that Putin acts against his critics all the time, domestically and at times abroad. But what's extraordinary, I think, about this particular case is now he's going out and attacking and intimidating a former U.S. ambassador and many other former government officials who have served Democrats and Republicans, by the way, were on that list. And he's decided to go after us all.
The whole idea that Trump is in the pocket of Vladimir Putin. I mean, Time magazine posted an image of Trump's face morphing into Putin's face. It seems too easy, and some would say it's far-fetched. But some have also said, you know, Putin, he's not that sophisticated. He's putting his money pell-mell on every number on the roulette wheel and coming up a winner. And as for Trump, he changes his comments every news cycle. How seriously do you take the Trump-Putin relationship?
Well, I can't speak to who's in whose pocket, and that's why we need Mr. Mueller to finish his investigation. I can say, having watched diplomacy at the highest levels in the Obama administration, being a part of it, so far I'm deeply unimpressed by President Trump's strategy for dealing with Russia. I don't know what the objectives are other than to just be friendly with Putin. And I'm not against diplomacy with even adversaries like Mr. Putin. But when you do it, you have to have some goal, some objective that advances American national security interests and American economic interests. And right now, it's just deeply confusing. And the second thing that's deeply perplexing about this situation is it seems like the entire Trump administration would agree with me. If we had them on the phone right now, I don't think Secretary Pompeo, Secretary Mattis, John Bolton, I don't think they would disagree with anything we're talking about, but their boss would disagree. But this story is not over, and already the whiplash we've had about what the president did and didn't say and what the policies are, you know, I think that gives a chance for the national security team to finally sit down with the president in the White House Situation Room and say, Mr. President, we have to have a more coherent strategy for containing Putin's Russia.
I mean, it seems Helsinki was a turning point for many people, but the pushback has only just started. How much can the president just go it alone?
He is the president of the United States. He's our commander in chief. That is true. But I do think there's an obligation from his national security team to, you know, I think they have three options. Let me put it this way. One, be more effective in providing advice. Two, speak out publicly, as Dan Coats did a couple of days ago when he was thrown under the bus by the president. He went out and made a statement. That was very effective. Or three, resign. Those are your three options. You either make it happen or you say something on the record or you have to get out.
Ambassador Michael McFaul, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Michael McFaul is a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. The 12 Russians indicted last week for allegedly hacking Hillary Clinton's campaign are all members of what's called the GRU, a Russian spy agency. It's one of Russia's three military intelligence agencies under the Kremlin's control.
The GRU, though, is the one that is really quite distinctive.
Mark Galliotti is with the Institute of International Relations, Prague. He's also written several books on Russian security services.
The GRU covers the span from the kind of regular military intelligence, you know, the second defense attaché in the embassy who's busy trying to work out how many troops has the other country got and what's its latest technology. But it also includes the Spetsnaz, who are like the kind of the Russian equivalent of the Green Berets, commandos. And it's very much that kind of gung-ho military approach, which also goes through to its operations. And beyond that, it's also got this increasingly important cyber espionage and subversion element.
Yeah, we'll get into that cyber capability in a moment. Tell us a little about the history of the GRU. When was it created, and historically, what operations has it been involved in?
Well, the GRU dates back to the Russian Civil War, right at the beginning of the Soviet era in the early 1920s. And it managed to survive the period of Stalinism, the Cold War, and even the collapse of the Soviet Union at a time when all the other agencies were busy being purged and renamed and such like. And it's always been, shall we say, the more adventurous of the agencies. In, for example, the Spanish Civil War before World War II, they were there on the ground supporting the anti-Franco forces. During the Cold War, the GRU was to be found in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, supporting sort of anti-Western partisan and other movements. So, you know, really from its earliest beginnings, these have been the guys who, as well as doing conventional espionage, are absolutely willing to get their hands dirty and absolutely willing to go into dangerous and uncontrolled spaces.
So the way we now understand it, it was specific units of the GRU that were accused of doing the hacking, these 12 officials who were indicted.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so tell us more about those units and how they actually fit into the agency.
Well, we've got to understand them in the wider context of how the Russians are thinking about future war. When they look at the West, and increasingly if they're thinking in the future of China, they realize they're going to be fighting enemies who are more technologically advanced than them. Given that they can't catch up, the next best thing is to disrupt that technology. So really, they're there to absolutely break into email servers and so forth, as we've seen with the indictment. But they're also there to, for example, break into the control systems of power stations and railway systems and put in little logic bombs that could be exploded in time of war to bring these systems crashing down.
And how long have they been working in the cyberspace?
Well, bit by bit, it dates back about 15 years.
Yeah, so does that mean that at the GRU, at least when it comes to cyber operations, you've got kind of like old, perhaps even Soviet veterans surrounded by young, whip-smart, you know, people who know how to deal with stuff online?
I mean, look, the very senior ranks of the GRU, yes, they are Soviet-era veterans. But actually, no, I mean, the computer and information warfare elements of the GRU are much more the smart post-Soviet generation. So it is quite a different sort of generation. But the interesting thing is that actually there hasn't been the kind of resistance we'd expect. The GRU really did take very quickly to understanding that the computer was the new Kalashnikov.
Wow. Did last week's indictments reveal anything new to you about the GRU?
Not so much about the GRU. More what it actually revealed was precisely the extent of the U.S. intelligence services' capacity to track these people.
Yeah, what do you think that actually says about the power of the GRU, specifically their cyber crime capabilities?
I mean, I think it says that we shouldn't overstate their power. Yes, the GRU and the other Russian agencies are pretty good at what they do. They have some of the best hackers around, but so too does the United States, and the United States has more resources to throw at the issue. But the bottom line is this. The Russians are interested in disruption more than anything else. And that means they get to pick the battlefield. They get to pick the time of battle. So they don't need to be better all the time. All they need to do is to be able to take opportunities when they see them. And that's still the Russian strength. They are weaker, but they are scrappy, aggressive, and they have the initiative.
So we've been talking about the GRU's cyber capabilities. What about other recent headlines like the Novichok attack on Sergei Skripal, the former colonel in the GRU?
Yeah, it's still an open question whether that was actually carried out by the GRU or one of the other agencies. But generally speaking, I mean, if one looks at the GRU, they have been involved in a whole series of operations. It wasn't just that they were crucial to the seizure of Crimea in 2014 and have been really heavily involved in the undeclared war in Ukraine. But we've also seen the GRU operating on the ground in Syria. We've seen them behind an attempted coup that took place in the Balkans, in Montenegro, to try and stop it from joining NATO. You know, they are very active. But the interesting thing is that these operations, they seem to more or less have something like a roughly 50-50 strike rate. Sometimes they succeed, often they fail. But that's okay, because the Kremlin seems to be accepting this notion that it's better to try and fail than not try at all.
Mark Galeotti with the Institute of International Relations, Prague. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Yemen has been engaged in a civil war for 4 years now. The government there is backed by a Saudi-led coalition, and the U.S. is part of that coalition. The war in Yemen often gets overshadowed by other conflicts, but there are some new disturbing reports coming from there. And a quick heads up, what you're about to hear is pretty rough stuff. A network of at least 18 prisons run by Yemeni officials were found to engage in secret detentions, torture, and sexual abuse of prisoners. The Associated Press and Human Rights Watch say those prisons are controlled by a U.S. ally, the United Arab Emirates. The UAE denies it. Last week, Amnesty International issued its own report, A Year in the Making.
The forms of torture that we documented included electric shocks, waterboarding, sexual violence.
Raya Rage of Amnesty International says the group interviewed scores of people, about 51 prisoners in particular, who are reportedly caught up in the system.
In one case, a father of a detainee told us that his son was kept for up to 2 days in a Yemeni prison without water, to the point that detainees had to lick water off the floors.
Rage says over the past 2 years, dozens of Yemeni men have been arrested and held without charges. Some have simply vanished, and their families get no word on their whereabouts.
The conduct documented in our report violates absolute prohibitions binding on all countries. Enforced disappearance and torture cannot be justified under any circumstances. And the violations of these rules, they constitute war crimes.
Rage says the international community, including the United States, should be applying pressure to investigate the situation there. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut has been outspoken on the war in Yemen. He's frequently called on the U.S. to limit its support for the Saudi-led coalition fighting there. That coalition includes the United Arab Emirates, which again is allegedly controlling the prisons engaged in torture and abuse. Senator Murphy, thanks for being here. What do you make of these reports of secret prisons in Yemen?
Unfortunately, it isn't surprising the conduct of the Saudi-UAE coalition inside Yemen and in the skies above Yemen has been absolutely appalling. You're talking about thousands and thousands of Yemeni civilians who have been killed, often targeted, and the news now of the torture happening in these prisons is frankly just going to further radicalize the Yemeni people, especially those who have been in the prisons or know those who are in the prisons, against a coalition government that may eventually be formed and against the United States. You know, what I remind my colleagues here in Washington is that everything that's going on inside Yemen is not seen as just the Saudis and the Emiratis acting upon the Yemeni people. The United States is seen as a vital member of that coalition. And so everything that the Emiratis are doing inside these prisons ultimately gets tied back to the United States. AQAP,
Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
AQAP is the most lethal arm of Al-Qaeda, at least with respect to their ability to attack the United States, and they are getting stronger inside Yemen because of the grievous wrongs being committed by the Saudi-UAE coalition, which ends up pushing people to these extremist groups.
Well, as you say, the U.S. is a vital member of the coalition. I mean, we just heard from Amnesty International, though, about some truly hideous stuff, possible war crimes. So bottom line, what is the U.S. role here when its allies break the rules of war, and what should the U.S. do about this?
Well, the U.S. should pull out of this coalition. The U.S. should stop supporting the Saudis and the Emiratis in these war crimes. I've believed for a very long time, dating back to the Obama administration, that the United States should get out of this war. That doesn't mean it's going to end. That doesn't mean that abuses won't continue. But the United States should not be part of it. Our reputation is being damaged seriously by continuing to be associated with these tactics.
And yet you turn on cable news and it's all Trump all the time, Helsinki, and no one's talking about Yemen. I mean, as you say, this goes back to, and you've been talking about it since the Obama administration. It's a long-running war that's almost 4 years old now. What is being discussed in Congress about it?
I have brought three different resolutions before the United States Senate to try to either pull the United States out of this war or limit our engagements. I've gained more and more votes for it every time. And so I think we're on the verge of winning a vote in the Senate to pull the United States out or to substantially change our participation in the coalition. But it's slow going. This is the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe right now. And what is worse is that it's happening because of the United States. Every single civilian death inside Yemen, every single cholera case inside Yemen has an American imprint on it because we have facilitated this just appalling conduct of the Emiratis and the Saudis, and we continue to support them, frankly, without reservations and conditions. So I'm going to try to continue to press my colleagues to pull us out of this coalition, and if we don't, I think the United States is made much more vulnerable to attack.
So, I mean, just as an aside, what are the numbers in the Senate? Like, how many votes do you need to pull the U.S. out of the coalition? Are all the Democrats on board?
So we have, you know, almost all the Democrats supporting either ending our participation in the war or limiting our participation. And we have a handful of Republicans, but we don't yet have 60. Of course, the issue is, even if we were able to get the votes in the Senate and the House, if we were able to forward a piece of legislation to President Trump to limit our participation in this civil war, there's no sign that he would sign it, because he has been the chief cheerleader of the Saudis. He has frankly increased our participation in this war, not decreased it. President Obama had serious reservations, and so he took some steps at the end of his administration to limit the U.S. participation. He pulled our personnel out of the bombing center. He refused to sell precision-guided munitions to the Saudis. Trump has put our folks back in to the targeting center, and he has started the arms flow pipeline once again to the coalition. So even if we were able to get the votes to stop this, I think President Trump would veto the bill, and I'm pretty sure that we couldn't get the votes to override him. This is a tough one so long as Trump is there.
Well, we reached out to the U.S. State Department for comment, and they said these allegations are disturbing, referring to the torture and the secret prisons. The United States takes all allegations of abuse seriously. We call on all parties to the conflict, including the UAE, to treat prisoners and detainees humanely and to ensure that allegations of abuse are investigated quickly and thoroughly. The State Department source said the U.S. and the UAE, quote, have regular discussions on many issues, including this. So the State Department is doing something, but are they doing enough?
The administration does not take this seriously. The administration has done nothing, nothing to suggest that it cares about the deepening crisis inside Yemen. In fact, they have done the opposite. They have flooded Yemen with more weapons. They have sold more bombs to the Saudis. They have given a blank check to Riyadh in its military campaigns in the region. So I read these statements from the State Department as almost totally, completely empty words. There are some very good people in the State Department. I know there are personally, I know there are people in the State Department who think that our policy is wrong there. But they are working for a president who has decided to cast his lot with the Saudis despite the war crimes that they are perpetuating inside Yemen today.
Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, thanks very much for your time today.
Appreciate it.
I'm Marco Werman. In Israel, Jewish lawmakers passed a bill that led Arab members of parliament to protest. They called it racist.
This law makes their status different than it makes my status in this state, and I don't think there's any way to sugarcoat that.
That story and more still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We hear a lot about finite resources, oil, gas, even water. But what about sand? It turns out, in parts of the world, sand is also in trouble, and so are the ecosystems and the people living near sand. It's all because of a global building boom that's creating an unprecedented demand for sand. Sand is used to make concrete and to create new land where land didn't previously exist. From our Livable Planet desk, Tess Vigeland reports from Cambodia and Singapore.
Deep in rural Cambodia, Chan Vana pushes his long-tailed boat through the calm waters of the Kokong Estuary. Until about 10 years ago, Vana and his family made a living fishing here. Then one day, giant machines showed up at their small inlet and started dredging sand from the bottom of the river. They never talked with our community, Vana says. They came to dredge and the land fell down and the water became deep. The land fell down because the dredging caused the riverbanks to wash away. Vana motors toward his former fishing ground in a small lake. There are no fish anymore, he tells me, because without any shallow water, the fish have nowhere to spawn. We stop at an eroded bank and crawl up to meet some of his neighbors. Small, gaunt children dance to a boombox while the adults snack on longan fruit. They, too, have lost their livelihoods. One of the men, Sali, points to the other side of the river. The water used to be maybe half a meter deep, he says, so we could cross over. Now it's 10 meters deep. What was once a creek is now a wide river. Sa says they've lost many trees that protected the land, and even the crocodiles left. It's a scene that's been repeated throughout coastal Cambodia for a decade. And not just here, but in Vietnam, Indonesia, Myanmar, Malaysia, and beyond. All part of a global sand grab that has made it the second most widely consumed natural resource in the world, behind water.
Cities are basically built out of sand.
Vince Beiser is the author of the forthcoming book, The World in a Grain, the story of sand and how it transformed civilization.
Every concrete building that you see, every mile of asphalt road between those buildings, all the windows in all those buildings, it's all made from sand.
Quartz sand in particular, the kind used in concrete construction worldwide, usually found on beaches and in rivers. And there's an unprecedented demand for it. The skylines of Phnom Penh and Ho Chi Minh City are unrecognizable from just a few years ago. Same with newly urban areas in India and throughout Africa, not to mention the insta-cities popping up all over China. It's the same urbanization that happened in the West over the course of a century, says Beiser, but now it's happening way too fast for nature to keep up, and in places where there isn't a lot of government oversight.
There are fewer regulations to protect the environment, and in a lot of places, there just isn't as much enforcement because there's a lot of corruption. And in some places, like India in particular, the business has become so lucrative that a lot of the business is actually controlled by what they call sand mafias.
Here in Southeast Asia, much of the finger-pointing about sand is directed at Singapore. But it's not just about new buildings. The island city-state itself has expanded by 20% over the last half century, purely through sand-based land reclamation.
Singapore didn't have its own resources of sand. They had to take it from their neighbors.
Alex Davidson is with Mother Nature Cambodia, an activist group that started protesting sand exports a few years ago.
And of course, they took it from places like Hong Kong, where there's corruption, local communities can be repressed.
Under pressure from groups like Mother Nature, Cambodia, Vietnam, and Indonesia have recently banned sand exports to Singapore. For its part, the Singaporean government says all of its sand imports from around Southeast Asia have been legal. But it doesn't seem eager to talk about the issue. The Ministry of National Development declined requests for an interview, but it knows it has a sand problem.
It's all becoming an embarrassment to Singapore that we're importing so much sand at the expense of, you know, the livelihood of our neighbors.
Lim Soon Hang is a Singaporean engineer. He's looking out across the city's Marina Bay, an area that not long ago did not exist.
Where we are now is all reclaimed land.
Right? The famous Marina Bay sands.
Right, yes.
Even after all its recent growth, Singapore's government estimates it will need to add another 22 square miles to its current borders to accommodate population growth. Lim runs a company that is trying to convince Singaporeans to do some of that expansion with floating pontoons. The technology uses a lot less sand than traditional land reclamation. It's already being used in massive port projects in the U.S. and Europe, and even in one project here. But it's been a tough sell.
So now we've moved down the bay a little bit, and we're looking at a floating structure right here in Singapore. And this is used for sporting events and...
Yeah, entertainment, for national events.
So you have proposed doing this all over the country. And what has the reception been?
The reception is not very overwhelming because they don't understand. They say it's not safe. It will wobble around. But you can see the structure there. It's not wobbling.
The jury is still out on pontoon building here. But other less sand-intensive approaches to expanding Singapore might catch on. Meanwhile, scientists are working on new kinds of building materials for all those new structures. Some would use less sand than concrete. Others would use different kinds of sand that are less environmentally sensitive. Because it's not like cities are going to stop building. Vince Beiser says the real question is how to do it sustainably, instead of turning sand into a new sort of conflict mineral.
Quartz sand is literally the most abundant thing on the planet. We have more of it than we have anything else. And if we're running out of that, which we are, then we're really in trouble.
Because just like when it speeds through an hourglass, sand itself may be running out of time. For The World, Tess Vigeland, Singapore.
As we just heard in Tess's report, scientists around the world are working to develop new building materials that are both greener and use a lot less sand. One of those scientists is Susan Bernal at the University of Leeds.
So, for instance, we can crush different types of rocks or byproducts from the production of steel. We can also use glasses that are also crushed. But the main issue with that is that we don't have sufficient volumes to be a long-term strategy to reduce completely the use of natural sand.
So the huge demand for sand isn't the only negative environmental impact from concrete production. I gather that concrete production and use also emits a huge amount of carbon dioxide pollution. Can you tell us how much and why that is?
Well, the main pollutant in production of concrete is actually the glue that keeps the components together, which is Portland cement.
So Portland cement is kind of the basic cement that we all know that is the glue in all concrete.
Yes, it is. So at the moment, the manufacturing of Portland cement accounts by 8% of the global CO2 emissions. And because this demand for concrete is going to increase significantly in the years to come, as we tackle poverty around the world and we provide infrastructure, especially in developing regions, we expect that by 2050, the CO2 emissions associated with Portland cement manufacturing will be 25%.
So you mentioned those different versions of concrete that try to use less sand, replacing it with crushed glass or cast-off products from rock. Are there good alternatives to concrete that emit also less carbon dioxide?
Absolutely. It has been recently a boom in developing new and alternative Portland cement-free binders when we substitute partially or completely that glue that keeps the components together.
So swapping out cement for alternatives, what are some of those alternatives?
For instance, when you burn coal in thermal stations, we produce a byproduct called fly ash that is highly available in many of the largest countries, for instance, in the U.S. We can use also waste from agricultural processes, for instance, rice husk ashes, waste from a mining industry, from metallurgical industry, but also we can use natural resources like volcanic ashes, we can use clays. So there is quite a lot of things we can do to utilize the large amount of waste we have.
Are builders actually using these alternatives, maybe not for huge skyscrapers, but, you know, small scale construction?
Well, the construction industry is very conservative. And to utilize these new green alternative cement or alternative aggregates, we need to comply with a great number of standardized values to make sure that, for instance, if we make a house, it's sufficiently safe for people to live in it.
You know, we hear so much about the development of electric cars and clean energy, but we don't hear a lot about greener alternatives to concrete. And yet, as you say, it's in massively high demand around the globe. Why do you think that is? Is it just not the sexiest topic, you know, concrete and sand?
Well, to be honest, I think you're right. It's not very sexy because everyone takes it for granted. No one wonders where cement comes from or how much we consume. We just need infrastructure. We need bridges. We need housing. And we just take for granted that they can be built. However, at the moment, with a lot of countries committing to reduce their CO2 emissions, there is a change in the culture of the construction industry, and they are starting to open up to take full advantage of these new alternatives.
Susan Bernal is a materials scientist who researches alternatives to concrete at the University of Leeds. Great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bassem Youssef was often described as the John Stewart of Egypt. Youssef was Egypt's most famous political satirist. His TV show attracted up to 30 million viewers a night. But then Egypt clamped down on freedom of expression, and Youssef fled his home for Los Angeles. Now he's trying to attract a new audience in the U.S. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez caught up with Youssef in L.A.
Not so long ago, the life of Bassem Youssef was a kind of fairy tale.
What makes sense of all that is Egypt's foremost political satirist, Bassem Youssef. Bassem, thanks for joining us. Welcome, sir.
He appeared on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Time magazine named Youssef one of its 100 most influential people in the world. And in Egypt, Youssef was adored by millions for speaking truth to power on his political satire TV show. But when I meet Youssef, he's in a no-frills recording studio on LA's Melrose Avenue, plugging a food delivery service.
I used to panic about how to eat every day, but not anymore. Thanks to Some Basket. Now you get more.
It's an ad for a sponsor of a new podcast series Yusuf hosts. One of many things he's doing to try to restart his life and career in the U.S.
I was never into podcasts. Still not. But I like talking to people. So why not? If you're going to give me money to do it, why not?
Yusuf became famous in 2011. During the Arab Spring, this heart surgeon turned comedian parlayed funny YouTube videos shot in the laundry room of his Cairo apartment into a popular nightly TV show where Yusuf poked fun at everyone from Egypt's military to the Muslim Brotherhood. But as Yusuf's fame grew, his life in Egypt got harder. He received death threats, a warrant was issued for his arrest, and after the military seized power in 2013, his show was taken off air. Yusuf fled the country the next year.
It's not like my career has ended because of like bad rating or anything. It was taken away from me because political causes.
Now, Yusuf is just another person in Los Angeles hustling to make it in show business.
I also made a peace with myself that I will never be as big as I was in Egypt.
But Yusuf is trying very hard to find new fans in the U.S. That effort includes his podcast called Remade in America with Bassem Yusuf, where he explores his adjustment to life here.
A new country, a new lifestyle, so many things to understand. Just like you, I'm trying to figure out how to belong in America.
When not behind the podcast mic, Yusuf does speaking engagements and stand-up at comedy clubs.
I'm really blending in. I'm a vegan.
He also takes meetings with Hollywood execs, hoping to land a new show.
There's always the hustle and bustle of Hollywood, and I can't remember how many times I went to Netflix. Everybody is working on certain kind of pitching stuff, and, you know, it's just like I'm trying to find my own niche.
But unlike much of his Hollywood competition, Yusuf is in his 40s with a wife and two young kids to support. He also worries that his accent might limit which roles he gets. So he works with a dialect coach and hones his pronunciation while recording his podcast.
Now let's get back to the interview and hear Maria's take on what's newsroom looked like.
You got the Maria part perfectly, just okay. The rest of it.
Now let's get back to the interview and hear Maria.
Yusuf says he does have an advantage, a distinct life experience compared to other comedians in the U.S., including those who weave the Muslim American experience into their acts, like Aziz Ansari and Hasan Minhaj.
They are Muslims, yes, but they are not us. I just came from the Middle East that all of you guys are afraid of. And I think there's a lot to be said from that part of the world. Not people who are already Americanized and Westernized.
While he searches for his big break here in his adopted country, Yusuf thinks often about Egypt. But he says the best way to serve the people of Egypt and explore issues that are important to him is to launch his career in the U.S.
I think we need to affect international community, not just talk within each other. And to do that, I need to be successful here. And if I'm more successful here, I'll have more exposure and more reach and more people will hear and see what's happening in the Middle East.
And Netflix, if you're listening, Bassem Yusuf is ready to take another meeting anytime.
After all, this is the United States of America, the greatest democracy on earth, right?
For the world, Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
America has long been called the land of equal opportunity.
You're tuned to the world. Same chance for success. Since its founding, Israel has defined itself two ways: as a democracy and as a Jewish state. It's been a tough balancing act and a source of great debate. Just this week, some in Israel tried to tip the balance of that equation. Israel's parliament passed something called the Jewish Nation-State Law, which basically says that only Jews have the right of self-determination in the country. Noga Tarnopolsky is a journalist in Jerusalem and has been covering this.
So what this law does is enshrine as law many things that Israelis have taken for granted forever, like what the flag of Israel is, or like the menorah as the symbol of the state, or like that Israel is a state for the Jews. All of these things have never been written in law, but they've always been the fundamental nature of the state.
So why do this law then?
I think the most honest answer I can give you is that what you see are a group of right-wing political leaders trying to position themselves as the most stridently right-wing, manly, nationalistic voice before elections that will come at some point in the coming year.
So it sounds like this is a political positioning bill. Will it be overturned?
I would say it's a political populist bill. I think at least parts of it are likely to be overturned, but I think We would be wrong to dismiss it as just populism and something that may be overturned, because I think chances are pretty good it can cause very, very big damage. For example, in Israel, for the last 70 years since the state of Israel has existed, Israel has had two official languages, Hebrew and Arabic. And as a result of this law, only Hebrew is an official language of Israel, and Arabic has become a language with a so-called special status that is undefined. And this makes me almost want to cry, because 20% of the population of Israel are Arabs, whose mother tongue is Arab. Significantly more of the population of Israel has a mother tongue of Arab, who are Jews born in Arab lands. And in Israel, every sign, every form, every official letter that has been published ever comes out in Hebrew and in Arabic. And it's an important part of the identity of the state. In addition, there's a very dangerous, vague, but very dangerous clause which gives advantages, prioritizes the importance of Jewish communities. And it's very easy to imagine how this law could be used or abused to harm communities that are mixed communities or communities that aren't simply not Jewish communities.
So it sounds like it could have serious practical effects.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, when this bill was passed, Arab lawmakers in the Israeli parliament ripped up copies of the bill and called it tantamount to apartheid. Was that grandstanding, or do they have a point?
I'm very sad to say I think they have an excellent point. And it's important for me to say that I have for many years opposed any kind of talk of Israel as an apartheid state. I think it's always been hyperbolistic and opportunistic. But I think these lawmakers yesterday have a point, because they're citizens of the state of Israel. We're not even talking now about the situation of Palestinians living in Palestinian territories occupied by Israel. That's a different issue. The members of parliament are citizens exactly like I am, and this law makes their status different than it makes my status in this state, and I don't think there's any way to sugarcoat that.
So, Noga, to just help us understand this, like, what do you think would be the equivalent in an American context? What kind of bill would this be in the United States?
Well, it makes me sad to say this too, but I think we could compare this to the attempted ban on Muslim immigrants, or to shutting down the United States as an asylum nation, in the sense that it is discriminatory against a specific population, and no less importantly, it attacks fundamental values that the nation has always held to through many different political moments in its history.
Noga Tarnopolsky speaking with us on the line from Jerusalem. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One tried and trusted way to deal with division and differences is through music. This comes from a husband and wife duo in Sweden, Susu and Maher Sisoko. Susu is from Sweden, Maher is from Senegal. Music, specifically the West African kora, brought them together.
It started when I was a kid. My father is a musician, and he was playing together with a kora player from Gambia called Alajimbai, and they were touring together in Sweden. So I heard him play the kora, and I was really fascinated, like, how do I play this instrument? I have to learn this one. So he invited me to come and study in the Gambia first. And then I learned some songs, and I performed in Sweden, and Maher's elder brother Solo Sisoko was there at my concert, and after that he invited me to come and study in the Sisoko family in Senegal. So that's how we met more than 10 years ago now.
In case it wasn't obvious, the kora is not an instrument often associated with Sweden, but it is the traditional instrument of Senegal. And Maher Sisoko, he was born into a family of kora players. 72 generations, 72 of traditional griots.
I'm from a griot family, which is like father to son, generation to generation. So it's like the rules of our art, what we are.
With the rise of populism in Europe, the mixed-race couple has recently had some jarring racist interactions in Sweden. It's something Susu says she never encountered until she had kids and married Maher, and their daughter began school.
I didn't expect my kids to be treated differently, so that was a new experience for me. It was a shock to me, actually, when she got to experience that, and I felt very frustrated as a mother because I really wanted to protect her, but I couldn't protect her, and she was in school, and the kids were being racist to her, and I couldn't protect her, so I felt like, wow, what can I do, you know? So then that's all behind this song.
Want you to know the love song that made you.
Their new CD is called Made of Music. Susu says the title track has special meaning for the family.
The title is like the meaning of our story because we met through the music. So the music brought us together. And we have two kids together and they are made of music. So the title song, Made of Music, is actually a song for our daughter to give her courage and strength and reminding her that she's made of music, so nobody can come and put her down.
Music made you. You're made of music.
And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
It's easy to say you're beautiful. It's easy to say do not despair. But you're the one with a burden.
PRI, Public Radio International.